Welcome everybody to today's programming languages. Today we're going to have a look at the simple and plain go-to, and we'll start and extend the underlying concepts step by step until we finally can talk about things like continuations. I don't know whether you have heard of them so far. So let's maybe dive right in. So in general, what we will see in this particular lecture is a lot about ways of manipulating the program counter in creative or dangerous or safe ways, depending on what kind of principle we are gonna use. But in general, it's all about like determining ways of manipulating the program counter or somehow retrieving information from program counter in order to jump there later on, and how that relates to like your mapping of addresses of some variables and whatnot is all involved in that. So the basic thing that maybe most of people already know is like the plain go-to that is always discouraged to be used. Nevertheless, it still makes its way into a lot of the languages that are out there. So here you might see something like go-to exit, and then this one. These are the two components of that. So you have labels, these buggers over here, with which you can give particular lines in your program a handle by which it can be jumped to from some other location in your program with this go-to statement and the label's name as parameter. So far, nothing really complicated. This is just like a shortcut in the control flow graph that goes from there to there. So nothing too fancy. And what you should keep in mind is for that is that this is usually considering that you stay within the boundaries of your own function, which usually comes from the thing that you keep your address environment the same. So you need the same stack frame to be there in order to address the same functions from there on. And this is maybe the motivation for, or this is for sure the motivation for this whole thing, staying local. So this is a very, very limited approach. However, you can still do a lot of stuff with that. And in a certain way, there is the other control structures like this for and if and while and all that are also just some specializations of the go-to scheme combined with some if then else in the fancy way of keeping labels. And this is like internally when the compiler does the target code generation, it uses basically go-tos all the way anyway. So yeah, that's just exposing a little bit of the internals of the compiler in a certain sense. So, but what else is there in terms of manipulation of the program counter? And well, let's just dive into the next best thing, which is like stack backward control flow. That's the name that I've given that type of thing. And this is essentially what is covered by construct that's called long jump. I don't know, is there anyone in the audience who has had some kind of exposure to long jump, set jump so far? No? So this is a very, very old construct already from the C language, and this has some functionality that is that goes a little bit further than the usual go-to from C. So this is supposed to work across the boundaries of a particular method. And yeah, how is that done? Well, I've looked into the sources of in this case it was it's a very free BSD that I have there. Yeah, so in principle, this is part of the C standard, but has some implementations that are go deeper. Like here, you see it's implemented in C, and there's a lot of code around the relevant parts that I've spared you here, like blocking of signals and dealing with SSE extensions and the FPU. But essentially what is done by set jump, long jump, is that at a certain point in your program flow, you say, I want to save this particular position of my control flow for later, and put that in an explicit structure with all the meta information that it needs, and continue on with my ordinary control flow. And at some point later in my program, I can use the so-called long jump with this structure as a parameter to jump back to the original point where I used the set jump. So set jump sets up your future control flow target. Long jump then goes the shortcut to that thing. And how this works is quite simple. The set jump uses the structure that it is given as a parameter in order to save a lot of registers. Other than the go-to, it backs up a lot of different registers that are meaningful for that particular program point, particularly the stack pointer is saved, the instruction pointer is saved, so it carries with it a little bit more context than the plain go-to. Also, you can pass the data structure around. So a go-to label, for example, is if you're not using any funky extensions of C, then usually a go-to label is like a constant that doesn't have a type, doesn't have a variable that can take that particular thing. So you can never really store it away somewhere and hand it over to someone else. It doesn't make any sense usually for intra-procedural control flow edge in that sense. So the set jump is instead giving you the point where the program flow continues in terms of a data structure, a data element that you can point to and, well, hand over to someone else. And on the other side, the long jump then obtains such a copy of this, or the reference to this structure, and restores the content into the current registers, which is a similar thing to, like, if you restore things like the stack pointer and the program counter, what you essentially do is you revert back to the old position in the program, although you have in the meantime like created a whole lot of different activation frames on the stack, for example, so stack frames that are representing open function calls and all that, but you kind of discard them by overriding these internal system registers with the former contents, so you fall back to earlier activation frames that have been created earlier on. So with that, you can kind of cross the boundaries of function frames in a particular way. One thing is maybe a little bit special, so the long jump gets not only one parameter but two. And the second one is one that is used for transportation of status information. So you can give it another integer that will then be taken from the parameters and be used as the return value of the later to be performed return assembly instruction. And remember, this return here is not a return of this long jump in a local fashion, but what it will do is it will it will return via the return address of the set jump. So the return address, which is usually found for the return statement on the top of the stack, is taken from this RCX here, which came from this data structure and was filled by the return address from the set jump. So this will then, in that sense, return back to the returning point of the set jump. However, it will carry as a return value this, which is usually found in the AX register, instead of the zero that is given back from the set jump, instead it will give back the second parameter from the long jump. So with that, you have a way of disambiguation between the regular return and the return via the long jump. Okay? So with that, let's have an example of this whole thing. So usually you have to, at some point, create first context structure that is used as the data structure to contain the information where to continue later on after a set jump, after a long jump. And you initialize that within such a set jump thing, which will set the address with which the program continues to the address after this set jump is executed. And since we have to disambiguate between, well, we don't have to, but we might want to disambiguate between the cases where we come over a long jump or whether we regularly terminate with set jump, we then have to interpret the example, and this is done here with such a switch. And the zero is the version where the set jump just goes through, and all the others depend on whatever parameter the long jump receives. So in our case, what this example does is it just goes through the switch and set jump, and first of all falls into case zero, where there's like some printout happening, and then we come to the long jump here, and the long jump, instead of falling through to the next instruction, will execute with this context parameter, which was set over here in this set jump, and this will continue execution back here at the end of the set jump with 2 as its new return value, which will then right jump to this case 2 and then continue this code 2 and then will exit. So with that, we have seen that there is potentially now some thing that is not reachable anymore, like this instruction printf here. Well, it's coming after long jump, so no wonder. You can now even cross boundaries between between some function that has been called as a child function within the original function. So here you see that we have this fun function be called and hand over the context address to the that one, and this will then be used in here under that name. And well, there might be some execution of that, like over here, if a number is not negative, which it is in that case, it will be decremented and called recursively. And then in the next iteration, we will then find that the number is now -1, which will lead to the else part being executed, which is then the long jump. And remember, this is already the second call of this fun thing. So we have already 2 activation frames for fun being open here on the stack. And now we do the long jump, which will jump back to whatever this thing is, which will jump back here and start executing again with now parameter 1 being the return value, so we will land over here in this case. And you have maybe already seen and parsed the comments over here, with something like that, the structure that we have here is quite similar to structure of a control flow element that we already have, well, usually heard about, well, not in this lecture particularly, but in things like Introduction to Computer Science. This is a lot like the exception handling is done. So this comes later on, it seems. So another thing that this might remind you of is maybe the transactional memory. I don't know whether you still remember how that went with the start transaction and rollback action. So such a long jump is a little bit like the rollback to the start of the transaction and, well, re-execution of the same parts with a different return value. So this is quite similar to that. So in terms of well, memory pictures, with the blue boxes being activation frames of each of these functions, this is like foo calling fun, with the error handler offering a way back to the original foo thingy, this calling another fun, and this still has the error handler as a way back to foo until this is actually then taken as the exit from the fun, and yeah, that. So what you still have to keep in mind with such a thing is that with that, although you get functionality pretty similar to what the exception handling does, the thing here doesn't keep you from cleaning up your stack in a meaningful, well, not a stack, the heap in a meaningful fashion. So the stack, of course, doesn't play a role. If you just discard the activation frames, nothing, not particularly much harm is done usually. However, any references to the heap that you have created during these executions of all these things, if you have cleanup code in the end of the function, this is usually not passed on this emergency exit that the long jump is. So in order to get a similar functionality, a lot more, a lot cleaner and a lot safer, there is this idea of the exceptions together with some way of stack unwinding, and what that then gives you is these components that you have already had sketched in code before, with the throw and the catch and the try, and this is achieving pretty similar things than we had before. And so you have these towers of activation frames that you can leave through the shortcut of throwing an exception, and the parameter is in that sense like the parameter of the long jump, and gets accessible again in the catch area of the whole thing. And since this is C++ feature in that sense, you might wonder how this deals with the need of cleaning up any remaining heap references from there. But what is usually done here is that the compiler does a little bit more work than the usual C compiler, in the sense that after each method's body, you usually get a table of exceptions that is caught in this method, as well as there is usually also a table with all the remaining open open references to the heap that needs to be cleaned up for a particular exception. So what usually is done is that there is, as soon as you start throwing a particular item as an exception, what then happens is the so-called stack unwinder is started, which then checks each of the functions in the stack whether the exception is caught. This is like the beginning thing, this to determine where the catch statement for a throw statement can be found. If no such thing is found, well, there is some way to bail out via termination. Otherwise, when you have found the correct stack frame Well, then there is the again a go through these appendices of the activation frames that will that can be used for cleanup through well, essentially some customizable way for the way that is implemented here. It's a very parametric way. It doesn't necessarily need to be the C++ language that is connected to this kind of framework. This stack unwinding library is used or can be used also for other languages. So it offers some configuration parameter, which is called this personality routine, that is there to clean up after like such a exception has passed several activation frames, and this personality routine will be called on the cleanup table and then can do custom stuff for whatever language there is. And for C++, it will then go through all these automatic variables and then just do the destructors and all these reference things. So, yeah, this is what the exceptions give you in addition to the long jump. So, but still, what we had with long jump as well as the exceptions was that we could like only travel from a child call to some kind of parent frame, and only in the direction backwards the stack. Can we do other things, or even more? So one idea is the idea of what I've baptized as same level control flow, which means that instead of traversing only back in the frame, what would be a nice idea maybe would be to transfer control from peers to one another, a little bit similar to what threads maybe can do. So is there something about that? And if you again start from the very low level, the C side of everything, what you can do is so-called stack switching with make context and swap context. Is that something that any of you have already done? No hardcore C hackers in here. So these are very low-level facilities to create like equally important execution units that you can that can switch control from one to the other mutually. So the concept is that you somehow represent the a handle where to transfer control to, or where I currently am, in form of some kind of data element, a structure in that sense, and this is done with this type uContext here, and this serves as a container for such a entity where you can jump to, or well, your own current position in that sense, and you can then, well, first of all, set up your system such that you create a lot of these contexts for, well, one for each of the peers that need to switch between them. And you create some kind of space on in the memory for this item to live, like an own personal stack in that sense, and then link them together not only via reference to this uContext thing, but in for the case that one of these processes terminates at some point, the scheduler then wants to continue somewhere else. So you link them all in some chain from one to the next. And yeah, with that, you are done with initializing and can you can then use this swap context in order to swap from your current context to a particular destination context. And usually when that happens, this swap context, similar to what long jump did, does not return and fall through to the next address instead. This is usually then stored in this reference or in this data structure that is appointed to there. So this then represents the new the way to return back to that particular position. But the execution is usually then continued at the second parameter. So let's have an example for that. So yes, this is a lot of small code. It's not really particularly interesting. I will highlight a few bits of that. So there is, for once, there's a central deposit for all the possible context switching entities. So there's a context for the main method, a context for the function F1, and a context for function F2. So this is just structures that are lying around there. We have a function F1 and a function F2 and a function main, and they are supposed to work together now in some way and switching control from one to the other. Concerning the functions F1 and F2, this is pretty easily executed, so there's not a lot that happens there except for status messages on the console. So usually the only actual interesting instructions that they have is calls to swap context. So they transfer control to some other entity, and they do so here, for example, by going from going to the context of F2 and storing the current execution in F1, and in the other one of F2, this goes back to F1 and stores its continuation point in the F2 structure. Okay, so they are not particularly complicated. They just switch around between themselves and give back a few logging messages. What else needs to be there is what you find in the main routine. So we said that we need to provide some form of memory for each of the communication peers that can then call each other. And this is what we do here with these instructions here. So this is just reserving space as the new stack for the function F1 and the function F2. And this is like, well, some high number. I don't know how you are supposed to come up with that number. It must be somehow sufficiently large, but well, it's maybe a tried everything. I don't really know. So, but the thing is that you have to provide such memory here and then put that into the management structure for that, like this context F1 and context F2. And you configure how much space all of these things have, and then with the final call of make context, finalize these things to be actually usable context objects. And these make context things obtain the pointer to the actual function as the starting point for that particular context item. The other thing that remains here is like the parameter for that, but that's void, so it's not a valid parameter here. Okay, and then the whole thing starts up by first swap context from the main context to F2. Maybe one thing of note is that we didn't initialize this context M in the beginning. Well, this is done by the actual swap context here. So this swap context will put all the necessary information for all the attributes of that thing already in there, and then switch to this F2. And this will lead to like the following execution. So here we get the first main swapping context to F2, which is corresponding to that swap context thing here, there the execution of the main will stop, and we will get into the execution of F1 with this part here. Yeah, and then we come to another swap context from F1 to F2. Sorry. This is F1 over here, so yeah. This one here is the one you see over there, and then we come to the swap context from F2 to F1, which will then start with the execution of F1, which is then this part here, which you find over here, and then we execute the swap context from F1 to back to F2, which only leaves this print of F2 returning over, which is done here, and then there's no explicit swap context anymore, but since the termination of F2 has finished, we go over to the definition of the context object for F2 and have a look at what the scheduler should do now by checking for the UC link thing. And well, in our case it seems that I have started the process without any parameter, so we will continue with F1, which means that now, what color didn't we use? This one. Now printf returning is called, and then this also terminates. We check for the next thing in line, which is the context for main, which has been set over here, and this is now it's this main exiting, which is this one here. So that's a way of switching between things that live somehow on a conceptually same level, so to say. Still, what the consequence of that is you somehow have to know about the size of the components here. You have to allocate these F1, F2 items manually, and this is usually done like in the parent frame or somewhere in the heap or wherever. So yeah, it's a lot of fiddling around with a lot of the details that are not so clear, and particularly if you allocate them like next to each other, as soon as you start allocating memory in that area, it's organized like a stack, so it will grow in some direction, so one frame might grow into the other if you don't reserve enough space for that or take any precautions for that. So well, there's a lot of very low-level things that you have to keep in mind with that. So also you need to specify a decent successor context at some point during the execution there, and this might also be tedious to do. So is there anything else that you can have in programming languages for switching between peers? And well, there's this idea of so-called coroutines. I don't know whether you have been exposed to those so far. So for example, in things like JavaScript, you get so-called generators. I don't know whether you have programmed with those so far. So these are usually obtained by this keyword function followed by a star, and with that you specify that the following function is now intended to be used as a so-called generator. And well, what gives that? That enables you to use a statement like the following here with a yield and some parameter, for example, this i++ here. And what that usually does is that will start creating an activation frame for that particular function. We'll start executing, until the first yield is encountered in the program flow, and at that point this particular generator or coroutine is suspended, and the given parameter is now ripe for plucking somewhere else. And this can be, for example, done like here. So here you see the, well, you could consider that like a main function, where the generator is initialized. So this will create an activation frame corresponding thing somewhere. And with a gen next, you start, or a reference to this generator thingy, which we called gen here. With the next call, we will start execution at the current status. Well, here it is just initialized, so nothing has run yet. So a first call to next will run until it hits the first yield somewhere. So this will then run through the statements from the body here until it hits the yield. And you can then obtain the parameter of the yield via this value thing, continue your execution here while the other thing is suspended, and then at some point reach this thing and go back to execution of the generator / coroutine by this interface.next thingy, and this will then continue the execution where we have left off with the yield, with the following instruction after yield, which is then in this case just reiterating through the loop, and well, essentially just generating a chain of ascending numbers here. And well, how that works is like following, where you start your main function with some kind of arbitrary function foo that is able to create or call, depending on what language you have, such a, I call it coroutine here instead of generator, because it's like a more general term. So this coroutine can be created and then maybe even started directly with a call, and this coroutine then, for example, can itself also call some other function, which will then reuse like the original function stack for being computed. There can be arbitrary calls on there, and in the end the return will go back to the coroutine, which only when it yields will go back to the original foo thing. So only the basic activation frame of such a coroutine is the one that can do the yield that corresponds to the original creation of the thing. So a yield can only be relative to the current generator that is created. So this yield only can then go back to this foo, which can then, for example, call the buzz. And in case that you have given over the reference to the generator / coroutine to buzz, this can then resume computation by calling the next in the case of the JavaScript thingy, which will then return control to coroutine, which can do whatever it wants, for example call another function return, and then does a final return at some point, which will then also go back to the meanwhile buzz activation frame of the whole thing. So that is what the stackless coroutines are conceptually. There's also another thing that is called the stackful coroutine, and well, we have already seen Lua in our times here, and this is an example for an implementation of coroutines that are stackful. So what is so typical about that in contrast to earlier on is, well, you get here, you create your coroutine explicitly with this coroutine.create. So this function here is corresponding to like this function start thingy from the JavaScript. And this starts new coroutine. And what you can do here is you can do things like this send, which is not a language thing, but this is a name for a function that we have defined earlier on, particularly this one here. So this is not keyword or anything. This is ordinary function call that we see here, which can be performed ordinarily within a coroutine. And in this child function call, then, what we can do is we can then perform a yield, which will then suspend this whole potential stack of activation frames that has built up during the creation of this stackful coroutine, and go back to the original place where the computation has started, continue there until it is resumed, where then this child activation frame is resumed, continues working, terminates at some point, and may reach some different level in terms of activation frames, and then do another yield, or finally maybe terminate. So in terms of nice, colorful images, the stackful coroutine, in that sense, what it does is you can create a coroutine at some point, and you see with this yellow frame over here, this has its own stack in that sense. And if it does some kind of function call, it will do so within its own stack. It can yield back to the original point, which is, in that sense, going back to the original frame, which can, in the meantime, open up its new activation frame in there, while the old activation frame from the coroutine can still remain suspended but still there, so to say. And within like this buzz child frame, you can then resume execution, which will then lead to the coroutine, for example, open up a new child, and in the end maybe just terminate with its complete call hierarchy and do a final return in the end. So the return, of course, well, this is the thing that needs to collapse the complete stack of activation frames again. So this is not a... the return procedure means that everything on the stack has already been terminated, of course. But the yields can be distributed throughout the whole collection of activation frames. Yeah? So this is the difference in those two concepts. So with that, you might wonder, we have already achieved quite a lot. Is there anything more that we can do? And well, can kind of think about having some kind of generic control over the program counter. And what that means is, well, we have to go a lot more special here. And what I'm going to show here is continuations in Haskell. Is there anyone who has seen Haskell so far? Nice. How? For fun. Well, you can enjoy this one. Good. So, there are several languages that have access to continuations or similar concepts. I wanted to do Haskell in this case because there you have like nice types compared to, for example, something like Lisp. And this makes it, from my perspective, a little bit more understandable what actually really happens in there. So, that's why I want to do that in Haskell. So, here we want to go a similar route as before and talk about execution contexts and points from which to continue with our current computations. And for, you might now wonder, when we talk about things like a functional language, what that actually really means. Because, well, usually in your common procedural language, you have things like sequences of statements where a thing like control flow points is like kind of explicit in there. Well, what does that mean if I go over to a functional language where I usually don't have sequences of statements? Well, you have to go with what you have, which is usually an expression. So that is an example expression. And still, although this is functional and doesn't have any statements, this is a thing that is executed on typical machines that are usually sequential in a certain sense, that they have basic operations that they execute one after another. So what happens during the evaluation of such an expression is that certain parts of the expressions are taken and already computed until and the intermediate result is then stored and waits for the next part of the expression to be executed. So with that in mind, we might want to be interested in certain expressions like this 5 times 2, which is like the if you start interpreting that particular expression, this is the one that we usually want to start with. So if we talk about such a thing, we might be interested of the context of such a expression, which would be, well, here we have the marker of the expression in there, and if we then take away this actual expression that we have usually in the beginning focused, we then have this thing here, which is what remains if we take away the sub-expression on which we have focused, and this is now the context of the sub-expression in the former complete expression. So this is the point, kind of the computation that continues when we have already done our expression 5 times 2. So this is what the execution context, the continuation point after that particular expression is. And yeah, the idea in this continuation approach is now to make this thing explicit and deal with that in some programmatic kind of way. So, this has been can be found in the reference from here, Reynolds, 93. The counterpart of these continuations would be like this thing here, and particularly this can be already partially evaluated to come up with the intermediate result, and the counterpart of that would, of this continuations is the thing that we call a suspended computation. So this is the in terms of this whole computation, if we only do that part, this is like only a partial interpretation of the whole thing. So you can see that as like a computation that has suspended at some point, but is intended to be finished by plugging this intermediate result into the continuation, and then it can be brought to a final value. So continuations represent contexts of certain expressions, and their counterpart, the suspended continuations, can be applied to such a continuation in order to create the final result. Okay, so this splits kind of control flow into two parts, and this is like what we want to talk with these go-tos and ways of transferring control flow. So the idea is now to make these control flow points explicit in programming, particularly in functional programming, which means that a little bit of a departure of the usual way that we specify programs in functional languages. So I've given you here a few examples of functions, how you would usually implement them in your normal direct way of specifying a functional program, and we're going to see how they transform into something which makes the control flow in terms of suspended computations and continuations more explicit. And to do so, what we will do is we will transform functions into functions that give you an explicit means of plugging them into their contexts, meaning their continuations. So, how do you do that? Well, you have to for example, well, usually you add another parameter in the generated result value that corresponds to the continuation. You do so, for example, for this square function by adding another parameter here to the outcome, to the result. So you make it from a constant into a function that that, given a continuation, applies the continuation to the result that you would have produced anyway. So with that, what you have done is you made the square, which would directly give back the result, into a thing that produces, what you would for the Java programmers here, a lambda expression. You would create a function, an anonymous function, that, given a function as parameter, applies that function to whatever I originally intended to give back. This is the first step to constructing such a separation between the suspended computations and the continuations. So for that, we had to change the signature of the function from the original parameter of int returning another int to parameter of int and returning a function that, given a continuation, returns whatever the continuation returns. Continuation has this is this finalizing step in the whole thing, which would consume our intermediary result and produce, well, we don't know yet what it produces, so we keep it open. But whatever the type is that this thing produces, this is what our final function will also produce. And this is this kind of transformations on the types that will be done on all these transformed direct style to continuation passing style functions will obtain. So let's have a look at the add function. This gets two parameters, int and int, and returns an int. What it originally did is it added x to y. In order to transform it into continuation passing style, is we need to be able to plug that into some kind of content context. So what we need to do is we need to give back, instead of an integer, we need to give back a function that consumes an integer and gives back anything and returns, well, then whatever the function returns. And all that we need to do here is we need to wrap the original computation into a new anonymous function that will just apply its parameter on the result that we have done so far. So that's the same kind of transformation that we've done before. And that way, we have produced another such continuation passing style function. So the interesting part is now what happens when we have things like nested expressions somewhere in our implementations. And this is what you see down there. So here we have a call to add that that gets its parameter calls to square of x and y. And this now makes it hopefully a little bit more obvious what we're going to do. In terms of signature, there's maybe not particularly much new here, so it's just two parameters of type int, return type int. You have seen how this transforms in terms of CPS transformation. This transforms into the same thing as for the add. So we get two parameters, and as a return type, we get the usual connection to some kind of continuation via this int goes to r. So how do we transform that now? Well, we have, in order to do that purely on other continuation passing style functions, what we do is the following. We start off with the innermost, or one of the innermost sub-expressions, like this square x, call the square x CPS variant, which we defined a little bit earlier on, with the original parameter from here. Yeah, And then we have to specify how to continue this expression. This thing is nested into the add together with a square from over there. So for that, what we have to do is we have to also compute this one. This is done with a similar call to square CPS. And we have to specify how the result of that is then propagated to another continuation. And this way of propagating the result is usually done by getting another parameter that is applied to the result then. So we each time we build up a new anonymous function, like here and here, that is there the result of that thing is applied to. So the result of this square CPS in red is going into this variable x underscore square and passed over to the expression beneath, where we first of all execute another square CPS of y then, and this result goes into this y squared. And now finally in the end here, these two results are then used and given over to the add CPS, and this thing also needs a function to continue, which, well, is the one that we get later on whenever this function is called somewhere else. We will know what the execution context is, and then this k will be filled in, so this is kept as a parameter in that sense. So with that, we have already made the first step in the direction that we wanted. We made the execution sequence that is necessary for the interpretation of this expression explicit, in the sense that we have specified it more sequentially, like the square CPS of x is the first thing that gets executed, then the square CPS of y gets executed, and then the add. This is like specifying how the interpretation of the expression is actually meant to be done. So in a similar fashion, you could do this transformation also for higher order functions, so for functions that get functions as parameters. So if in direct style you had as a first parameter a function and as a second parameter and a simple data element and returned a simple data element, you could program a body like this. If you would do that in CPS style, well, what we said is that if you transform a direct function into a CPS function, the signature changes significantly from A goes to B to A goes to B goes to C to C. And this is what a function parameter now would also have to account for. So this thing has to be adapted to be a type that is suitable for a continuation passing style function. So this goes into this type here. So this still takes A as a parameter, but it doesn't return an A, but suspended computation. And the return type, of course, also has to be transformed like that. And in terms of the actual body, what we also do is we make the transformation on the expressions, which means that we start with the innermost application of F, which turns into the first call of F CPS. The second one goes here, and the third one goes there, and they are connected via this particular glue that consists in the these anonymous functions that always transport the result value to the next function. So, yeah. So much for like the automated transformation between these things. You might first of all wonder, particularly if you were raised as like a iterative or procedural programmer, well, isn't that really horrible to look at? And this looks really, really inefficient. And well, let's tackle those things. There is one thing in functional programming which is like the central optimization, the mother of all, which is the tail call optimization. And this is there in order to cope with like the plethora of function calls that are usual in functional programming and makes them bearable in terms of the runtime engine that needs to execute them. And well, what that does is what you can see in this example. So here we have a not particularly sophisticated program that starts off with a main and then just starts calls a function foo, which itself then calls a function bar, which then calls a function buzz, and then does some final stuff. And in between, there is some transformations of the parameters. So all what we have in there is all these programs here consist in just some operator applications on the parameters, as well as a final call expression. That is the last expression that constitutes to the return value of a thing. So it's these are if an expression has a call as its outermost expression, then this is usually considered to be a tail call expression. And these are expressions that we can optimize in a particular way. Namely, since the ordinarily we would open a new activation frame for each of these calls here, but since this is only the very last last action for this old activation frame, and afterwards we will only use it like when the whole branch here has terminated with a return, then we have a whole lot a whole chain of only return statements left, which would quickly diminish the complete frame activation frame stack here. We could think about, well, already giving up this activation frame in advance before we start to execute the next function, and so to say recycle the current activation frame for use with the next function. And this is what you're going to see animated in the next few slides. So here is the conventional execution. Here you see the tail call optimized execution. So what we will see here is we start with main, which will call foo in both of the cases. So this will usually lead to, and you will see that I've done a few modifications in here, to propagation of the original parameter into the occurrences of these parameters in the expression. This will happen for both of them, and we will then perform the operations on those on both sides. But now we start seeing different behaviors on both sides. So for the case of unoptimized code, calling bar here will open just a new activation frame and keep the other one suspended until the whole thing is executed. Whereas here, what we will do is we have realized that this is a tail call here. Bar is the last expression to be executed before the execution terminates. So we don't need this activation frame for much longer. So we will recycle that by reordering the parameters so that they become or that they land at the right positions for the formal parameters of the newly called function, and then just instead of to performing a call, we will just do a go to. We just jump to the next instruction, which was already an instruction in bus. And I have done so by kind of inlining this bus thing now to this body, which will be somewhat what happens on the machine. So on the side of the unoptimized thing, we will have a new bar frame opened while the old foo frame is conserved. Here on the optimized side, the bar frame will be where the old foo frame was, and well, we just jump to the start of the what has been the bar frame and has now been moved into the body of the foo frame. And again, we have the parameters to operate on, which will be resolved into this 100 thing, and now we have a similar situation again. The bus will lead to a new function frame being created over there, whereas here we see this is the last call of the whole expression evaluation. We can recycle the current function frame again and just inline just establish the correct layout of the activation frame by shifting around a few data and then just jumping directly there, which will lead to a situation like here, where we have then inlined whatever bus has been into our original frame, which had been the foo frame long ago, and perform the computation that is done here deeply in this bus thing directly in there, and yeah, be done with that. So with that, you see that you can recycle a lot of the function frames. So function calls are not as expensive anymore as they have been before. You don't need to allocate a lot of space. You only have to maybe shift around a little bit of the intermediate results a little bit, depending on how the stack layer of your language actually is. And then you can reuse the existing stack frame and just jump to the called function instead of doing a full-fledged call as you would do in the unoptimized version. If you're more interested into the specifics of how such a thing can be implemented, I would refer you to either the original implementation, of course, but also in the virtual machines lecture next semester, you can see how such a tail call optimization works on like functional language. So with that, what we have is in our transformation, when we have CPS versions of our functions, this will implicitly make all the function calls that are in there be tail calls. So with that, you will on the one side get a lot of function calls, however, all of them are of a sort that can be optimized with like tail call optimization so that they are not that expensive as you would have imagined. So let's go a step further. What we have seen in the Pythagoras program was that we have composed these CPS functions in order to create larger fragments of code, and well, let's have a look at what the essentials of these compositions have been. So what we do is we take usually a suspended computation, so halfway interpreted subterm, and do the next step in the interpretation by taking some function CPS style and compose it to the suspended computation to obtain another suspended computation. In terms of signature, what that means is we take a suspended computation like this. This is the signature for the suspended computation. We take a CPS style function like this one to continue the suspended computation with, and then return another suspended computation, now with adapted types, depending on this quasi return type of the CPS styled function, being the new expected type for the suspended computations continuation. And well, what that means is that with that we can specify the signature for the composition of these peers the following way. So compose takes a suspended computation CPS function and returns another computation that has transformed the former result into the new result type. Yeah. So what does a compose then have to look like? Well, usually we can what the suspended computation was all about was that it could be continued by another function by consuming a thing of type A, and if you want to achieve to give something like that back, this is what the CPS function also needs to give back. So this is already quite suited for what we want to achieve. So let's have a look at the implementation of the composition. And this is just the essentials what we have used in the Pythagoras example in order to glue them together. So we had an initial suspended computation that was given to us via this S. And we would want to connect that to the CPS function F. We can do so by giving a function that takes the result of this S and gives it over to F as a parameter. So this is what this pattern is all about. And then the only thing that we have to make sure is that after F, we continue with the overall continuation, which is put into the system in this anonymous parameter way and given to F over there. So this is just essentials of composition in there. So we have done so already a little bit earlier on, a little bit more intuitively. So almost. So, to make this whole idea of suspended computations and continuations more of a prominent feature of programming, we now introduce a data type for the suspended computations that we want to use for continuation. And this is what we do with introducing a new data constructor for Haskell data type with a few functions that that convert our so far manually set up systems into these explicit data elements. So this is like conversion routines, like this cont is a routine that takes suspended computation in its original typed form into an explicit data element that is like written like this. And we have vice versa, we have another function, this runcont, which takes such a continuation together with a finalizing function AR that will then compute the final result of the whole thing, which is typed the same way as this finalization function and given back as final value. So if we now introduce this kind of data structure into what we have defined earlier on with this compose function, which was this one here, we can start to gradually transform this signature and implementation to one that is compatible to this new data constructor. So we start by replacing the partial computation from the result by this cont RB type, which will mean that we will, which means that we have to introduce this cont data constructor function, creation function here in the on the global level. Then we maybe, well, which one is the next one that we will continue with? The continuation on which to compose the CPS function. Well, if we do so, we will need to unpack the continuation again before we can actually apply it by doing the run cont. And then there's only one thing remaining that still has potential for replacing, which is this part here. So the CPS function, we will we will transform into this new version based on this cont data type, which just means inserting another conversion routine. So you might wonder why we have done that, and this has to do with a particular thing, namely the way that the signature for the whole method now looks like. This is pretty similar to the signature from over here when we just replace this cont R with such an M thing. We arrive at that signature, and this is a very special signature. This is a signature for the bind operation on monads, which is a particular way of, well, this monad thing is a particular trait for data types that allows us to do a few special things. Particularly, if you have a monad and have registered a thing like this compose thing as the bind operation for the monad, together with some other things we'll talk later on, we will be able to use a special facility here that provides syntactic sugar for operating with these basic data types, with these suspended computations. And this will give us a thing that we can move on from this very explicit, very complicated specification of applications of this bind function, which was our composition. Remember this the way that we nested the Pythagoras implementation was very similar to this one, with a lot of anonymous functions specified. And, well, we can move over to a syntax which looks a lot more like imperative programming, where we take the result of one thing, store it in one variable, take the result of another thing, store it in another variable, and then call a final thing somewhere. So this is already quite a lot like imperative programming. And indeed, what we can do is we can use our compose function as the bind function for a monad. So this cont R thing is actually an instance of, or is a monad in that sense. The other thing that we have to give here is a function that creates an initial starting point for the this cont monad, which will work this way, that we just take an arbitrary value and transform it into a function that consumes this arbitrary value, and this is now our initial suspended computation thing. And with that, we can now take our Pythagoras CPS version and transform that into the monad version, which will make it a lot more readable and not such a pain to specify. So we now can specify this formerly very complicated thing in the way that we just specify square cont x goes into x squared, square cont y goes into y squared, and then what we execute is add cont of x squared and y squared. And with that, we are now in a field where this already looks a lot like just iterative programming. I think it's not so alien to actually specify these kinds of things, is it? No. And this is given to us by implementing all the things that we need for the cont data type to be an instance of monad. So with that, we can write programs that already look a lot like iterative programs. Why did I go all these through all these hoops? This was due to one particular feature in Haskell, which is the call with current continuation. This is already quite an old concept and has been first done in Lisp, but Lisp is like without any types and very fragile to use, to say so. I prefer this version here. And this is a particular feature that you can use when you specify your programs in the way that you've seen here, in this pseudo imperative form with these continuations and suspended computations as like the basic concepts in there. And this is a function that makes a particular continuation of your current computation accessible later on. The way that this does that is the following. So, okay, this has shifted the coordinates a little bit, it seems. Strange. Okay, so this call CC thing is is there formulated with these with this cont data type in the beginning, but this means that there's a lot of conversion routines cluttered throughout the implementation there. So I have reformulated the whole thing in the variant without all these conversion things, so that we don't get distracted by those. So what this call CC does is this is a function that you call with another function as a parameter. This is this first function f here, and when this call CC is executed, this will immediately call this function here. So the function that you give to call CC is called first. And what it what it also will do is that, again, this is shifted. You will obtain access to the original continuation of the function that is supposed to go in here explicitly within the body of some function that is handed over to the F. So with that, you can have a function that gets the continuation of the call CC accessible in an execution in an anonymous function in there. With that, you can then go whichever way you want. You can directly call this this function now within this F, for example. If you do so, you will then continue execution after this call CC. You can also just terminate with this F, go your ordinary way, continue with whatever call CC follows, and potentially pass a reference to this anonymous function out there and use that to jump back to wherever this call CC was called originally. I think this is a lot easier to see in an example. So let's have a look at a call CC example. And one thing maybe up front, please ignore a few of the words that you see here. For example, this lifting thing just has to do because I do output here together with this continuation style programming. So this is just parts that you can just ignore and don't really read. So the only parts that are interesting are the ones that you see like over here at the moment. Okay, so this is a sequence of executions that you get here. So you to put put string with a new line, creating an output of A, and then you do output of B and output of C. So this is just a straight line program, nothing to be scared about. So let's start what happens to see what happens when we insert such a call CC. And remember, call CC gets as a parameter a function that gets as a parameter the current continuation. So this is the function that is given as parameter to this call CC and immediately executed, and it obtains the continuation of call CC, which is whatever follows down there as a parameter here. And we can now freely use that. For example, we can call that thing. When that happens, well, what happens is execution will remove the current continuation of K and replace it with that thing, which means control will switch over to here, which means that on the output, what we will have achieved is this A. Then we do call CC, execute the function that we are given here with a D. Then we execute the continuation, which will go back to the continuation of the original thing because that has been given to the current function, and continue there with B, and then with C. So this is already quite close to what we had already. This is like this exception handling. So this is called a one-shot or escape continuation, and resembles what we have seen as exceptions already. Yeah. So what else can we do in there? So let's have an example here. So this is a little bit more tricky. So call CC here obtains as parameter the continuation, so whatever follows after call CC. And it executes this thing here. And this thing here now doesn't call the continuation directly, but puts it into an expression that is bound to a function f and gives back this function. So if that whole thing is executed, this red box will execute and construct a tuple which carries a function that that will execute the continuation together with a parameter x that will essentially just be given back again later on. We'll see how that turns out. So it will create such a function and return it in a tuple together with zero. So the whole thing will terminate, and we will find here in K the this weird, strange function that we have constructed over there, and will essentially somehow call the continuation at some point, together with this zero thing that is bound to num. Okay? So then what will happen is we will execute B and C or as we have done before, and now we continue with, well, reacting to whatever we have gotten back there. So num, if num is smaller than 5, what we will do is we will do something with K. K has been the first part of the tuple, which had been this function that would call the continuation. And it would call this function is parameterized with num plus 1. Num has been 0 so far, is now 1, and is passed to this ominous function, which means that here in this x, now we will find 1, which will then execute the continuation and return again itself, but now with 1 as parameter. So we will jump back here, have the same function as before, as the first component, but now num is 1. Execute the whole thing again, run into the same thing, increment the whole thing, go back here, and so on. So this is essentially encoding a while loop in purely functional programming. So this is what comes from that. So there's this A, and then we have repetitions of B, C, I think it's six times, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So it's 0 to 5. And then in the end, we just print the num thing. And what we have seen here is that we have essentially left execution at a particular state in a reference, then have gone on with our program, which would deconstruct the call stack, and then later on used the call to this continuation to jump back to an earlier point in the state sequence, which still had another stack. So this looks like a situation. Well, it's already pretty late, so I won't go too much into detail of that one. So this is like an arbitrary program to just show you what happens there. And essentially what you have to look at is there is a call CC call over here somewhere that will at some point store the continuation of call CC, meaning the complete context that still has to be executed of that, and will ordinarily terminate, thus leave the stack frame and potentially popping it from the stack until a point where we branch over to an activation frame where we will then execute the continuation, which would mean that we will have to again come back to this original activation frame, since, well, this is when call CC has been called last time. So in order to implement continuations, we need some way to revert back to this old state, which means, well, either branching your stack into a tree-like structure, some kind of graph or anything, or find some other clever way to do that. There's a lot of science going into how to do that, or has been done at least. And yeah, it's not a particularly trivial thing, but with that you can do a lot of amazing things, like well, what you have seen so far me doing was like a thing which leads to something similar to exception handling. You've seen a thing like a while loop, which means it's already the path to standard control structures. This is also the way that you can go in order to implement things like Go routines. You can even do things like backtracking solvers for people who are have been in virtual machines lecture. The Prolog machine back then has essentially been a backtracking machine, which could have been easily implemented with just call CC in something like Haskell. So if you're interested in that path, virtual machines will show you a little bit how that can be done, for example. So yeah, this call CC is in that sense one of the most flexible ways of manipulating control flow that fits somehow into this topic. So to sum up, what we have seen here is some kind of stairways from simple go-tos over long jumps to like these same level switching constructs like set and swap context. We've seen exception handling and stackful or less coroutines, and in the end these single or multi-shot continuations. And yeah, if you're interested in more details in that, well, there's also a little bit more that you can do, similar to like these call CC constructs. There's also partial continuations, which give you ways of just kind of cutting out certain fractions of expressions to be used later on. There's, if you're fascinated by this call CC thing, you might be interested also in other calculi like the Y combinator or the SKI calculus. All these are like fascinating patterns that give you insights into how expressivity of languages actually really can be composed. So, and if you're interested in deeper reading, this one has a little bit more references, so here you go, have fun with that. And this like terminates our lecture for this semester, and I hope you had a little bit of fun and nice insights into programming languages with that. Have a good day. And good luck in the exam, of course.